It's time for On Your Money. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, August 28th. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is here with more information and advice on your money. Kevin will take a look at a new study that rates Wisconsin rather poorly when it comes to generosity. He'll share some advice on dividend-paying stocks and some tips on saving money on coffee. And we will welcome your questions, your personal finance questions, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
I'm glad that you are there. We were a little unsure, run into a traffic jam or something this morning.
Yeah, both of the helicopters I used to get into the studio were malfunctioning, so we had to take, it's actually the moped, which my driver and I, the weight limit was difficult for us to get the speed that we needed to get through all the red lights, so we're here.
I'm glad you're there, and did you have a nice vacation, I hope?
I did. We spent some time at a lake called Dutch Hollow, a hidden gem over in the south central part of Wisconsin. And it was great weather, good fishing, a lot of fun with the kids and the family. And I am so glad that it is over.
That's the way vacations are sometimes. But we are happy to have you back for sure. And I'm interested in your take on this this study that was in the news recently that says Wisconsin residents are not as generous as most of the other 49 states. We're a bunch of cheapskates?
Well, it's gotten a lot of press, and it was from the Chronicle of Philanthropy, which is a very respected organization. It was the study was entitled How America Gives, and what the sponsors did is they went through thousands and thousands of tax records of Americans all around the country, classifying them by state and by income and by age. And they actually were able to track about 60% of the dollars given by individuals in 2008, the year of the study. The nationwide, the study sponsors used a number they called disposable income, which we'll get to that in a little bit. But they said nationwide, people contribute 4.7% of their disposable income, about $2,500. And Wisconsin was 44th in the rankings, contributing just $1,747, about 3.4% of their disposable income. But it might not be as miserly as we appear to be.
How so?
Well, the methodology of the study, the sponsors even admit to it in the study that there are several issues with their figures and why they may be incorrect and not show an accurate portrayal of the picture. First of all, because of the income limits, they only looked at itemized. They looked at Schedule A's of the tax form, and to get a tax deduction on a charitable donation, you have to file it on the Schedule A. Well, a lot of people don't itemize their taxes and their deductions rather, and the lower your income is, the more likely it is you're just going to take the standard deduction. Only about a third of filers actually do itemize. And because of the disposable income, because of the cultural and societal differences of several of these other states compared to Wisconsin, it really changed the way our picture looked.
Yeah, and I know personally I might give a lot to Goodwill or Salvation Army or that sort of thing, but I don't collect a receipt for it. And so I give, but I don't claim. Which makes me dumb,
and,
right?
No, not at all. It's very common, and it's actually, I think, more noble even to give without worrying about the tax deduction. I think people should definitely try to get every tax break they possibly can, especially when they are giving. But a lot of people are not motivated by that primarily, and a lot of people in Wisconsin do not have higher incomes compared to the higher incomes of other areas. The cost of living here is lower, therefore the wages and incomes are lower as well. The state median income is about $50,000. That's lower than the national average. And again, with the majority of residents not itemizing, the majority were not tracked here. Also, if they did track every single person as a percentage of income, people who had lower incomes and gave any amount at all, which most people do, the percentage of their income would be higher, therefore raising it up instead. We also have an older population as well, people who are more likely to have lower income because they just live on Social Security or interest. But they might have more assets, and they also might be more likely to give and less likely to itemize. So there's a lot of very generous Wisconsinites who aren't showing up in this survey.
Yeah, anything else of interest from the study?
You can take it with a little bit of grain of salt, like we said, but there were some income differences. People who made between $50,000 and $75,000 gave 7.6% of their discretionary income versus about 4.7% for people who made over $100,000. And as I mentioned, the religious differences, people who belong to a religion or areas who had a strong, say, Mormon population where they have a strong tithing tradition in their religion, places like Utah and Idaho, those people had a higher percentage as well. The tax incentives did matter, excuse me, but not maybe as much to most people as might be believed. And also, people who were wealthy and lived in areas where they had more money than a lot of other people gave a greater percentage of their income than people who were wealthy with a similar level of wealth but lived near other similar people. And typically that makes sense because probably a higher cost of living relative to the amount of income. But in the next few weeks, not only will we be talking about how you can give wisely this year, but also reduce your taxes perfectly legally while you're making gifts that you want to. And you have a great opportunity to demonstrate the Wisconsin charitable interest by contributing during our membership drive on October 2nd and October 9th of the On Your Money broadcast.
Looking forward to that. And I do feel better knowing that this these numbers, there's more to these numbers than meets the eye. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And with that being said, if you have a question about personal finances for Kevin, call us now at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. It's time now for the On Your Money email bag, and an email from Peter says, "Joy, Kevin, great show. What a great service this is, and fun. I have been one of your dozens of listeners for a while now." Very good, Peter, very good. He's a widower under the age of 60 who believes he is entitled to a survivor's Social Security benefit after the passing of his wife. However, he wants to know how to make the most of his income and if he should contribute an equal amount to a pre-tax retirement plan to offset the extra income. Kevin?
Well, very good, Peter. First of all, yes, we do have the latest Arbitron ratings, and we can't talk specifically about it, but the number is now in the double figures of listeners to this show. So you are now one of many, and thank you for your false praise as well. That certainly helps get your question answered on the air. The first step, Peter, is to confirm the survivor's benefit by contacting the Social Security Administration. Generally, this is something that people get if they are at 60, even if they remarry afterward, or if they care for a minor child. There also is a Social Security benefit as well. A lot of times people don't know about this because they just concentrate on the retirement benefit and not all the other disability and survivor benefits offered by Social Security. The amount and duration of the amount depends on several things, including his late wife's earnings history and their ages, etc. It can be taxed just like retirement benefits. If he does initiate this before 66, normal retirement age, not only will it be reduced, but it could be reduced also by his earnings if he's under the age of the normal retirement age as well and over age 62. He can go to ssa.gov or call 800-772-1213 to get more information on how exactly this might help out his situation.
So let's assume the check is coming in as he anticipates. Is there anything he can do to improve his situation besides just spending it or saving it?
If he is actually working and earning and he has access to an at-work retirement plan, he should increase his contributions to the pre-tax retirement plan because it won't offset the loss of the penalty, the pre-normal retirement age penalty that many people get, but it will offset his taxes, and he should definitely contribute enough to get the employer match, and then next concentrate on getting his income down below the 15% federal tax bracket ceiling. This is line 43 on your 1040. For single filers like Peter, it's going to be $35,350 on line 43 of the 1040. And then if he wants, he can put money into a Roth IRA. He won't get any tax break on that, but he can pull the contribution back out whenever he wants with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. If he doesn't think he's going to need the money, though, I would much rather have him see him make the pre-tax contribution and get that break now while he's working, because in retirement, generally people's tax rates are lower. And then when they pull the money back out, they'll notice a big difference between what they were able to deduct when they made the deposit while working and the rate at which they pay it when they pull it out.
Thank you very much to Peter for that email. If you have a question for Kevin, you can email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also call us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can post it on Facebook, the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. Let's take some calls. Chris in Stevens Point is with us first. Hello, Chris.
Good morning.
Morning. Yes, your question.
Yes. First of all, I'm retired and a widow. I sold my home, which was paid for, and moved. Now I'm interested in buying another place. My question is it good to pay for it or take out a mortgage?
Can you pay for it, Chris?
Yes.
Okay.
With the
do you have other assets?
She said with the proceeds of the house, she can pay
correct.
For it.
Yeah, yeah.
Correct.
Do you have other assets besides the proceeds of the home that could cover, say, about probably 200 times your monthly living expenses?
200 times my monthly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me give you an idea. Let's say after...
Okay.
Are you working right now, Chris, or are you
I'm
Social
not.
Security? Or?
I'm on,
okay.
Yeah, Social Security.
You're on Social Security. Okay, take your... Do you know what your monthly expenses are first?
Yes.
Okay, good. Take that dollar amount in your mind. You don't even have to give it to us right now. Subtract what you're going to get from Social Security or a pension, and then multiply that figure by about 200. And so let's say you're spending $4,000 a month and you're getting $1,000 in Social Security. That leaves $3,000. And if you multiply that by 200, you get $600,000. If you have that amount of money, then yes, you can probably just pay cash. If not, and this seems counterintuitive, but you should actually look at getting the mortgage. And the reason being is that you can afford to get the mortgage, assuming you can qualify for one. But if you don't have that much liquid assets, having all of that tied up in your house really can put you in a bind if something else should come up. Let's say you have a personal emergency, like paying for a new roof or something, or you need to buy a car, or you have an uncovered medical expense. It can be very difficult to get that money back out of the house that you've already paid for. Whereas if you have a mortgage and you're smart enough and diligent enough to keep the money set aside, you can always pay the mortgage off early if you want. But if you need the money at the time, you can pull it out, and all you have to do to keep your house, keep your mortgage, and keep things moving is to just make that single monthly payment, which I'm guessing on the types of houses you're probably looking at, your Social Security check, which is extremely reliable, will make that mortgage payment for you. So offhand, I'd rather have you get a mortgage. Have you talked to any lenders yet, Chris?
No, I haven't, just because I feel that I do have it. But, you know, I just need to check out some of the angles, I guess.
Yeah, I would pursue the mortgage first. You might not even be able to get one, because sometimes if you don't have any earned income, some lenders won't even give people the mortgage. They don't mean to offend you. It's just that your numbers don't fit into their specific software, what they use to qualify borrowers. I would talk with the lender, see what kind of terms you can get. And keep in mind, you can always, are you over 62 or not?
Yes.
Okay. If you are over 62, you can always get, or at least under today's rules, get a reverse mortgage against that paid-for home. So even if you do say, no, I'd just rather write a check for this, be done with it, not have to worry about the mortgage payment, not have to worry about the interest, you may be able to get a reverse mortgage in the future that's technically a loan against the equity in the home that you never really have to pay back until you move out of the house or sell. And even then, the risk of paying it back is borne generally by the lender and the taxpayer. Not by you. So if you decide, I would recommend you get the mortgage. I recommend you get a 30-year mortgage, a fixed rate. But if you say, I can't do that, or I can't bring myself to do it, then I would keep that reverse mortgage option in your back pocket as an emergency if something should come up down the road.
Good luck to you, Chris. Thanks a lot for the call. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money. And our next caller is Joe in Whitehall. Hello, Joe.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Morning.
I just had a question for you. I recently rolled over in a 401 retirement from a previous employer to another investor, and it's because it's over $40,000, I'm being charged roughly about 2% every quarter for total fees and expenses, and I'm wondering if I should be shopping this thing.
I'm sorry, shopping, did you say?
Yeah, just, you know, looking for a different investment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
2% every quarter. So, I'm sorry, let's just say it's $50,000. They're charging $1,000 each quarter, so $4,000 a year?
Well, no, it's about, I guess, close to $300 every quarter, which, you know, I mean, if it's 10%, it'd be $5,000. If it's a $50,000 fund, you know, 1% is $500?
On $50,000, that's correct.
Yeah. It just seemed like it's quite a bit, I thought.
Is it someone who's giving you financial advice, or is it, an annuity, or what type of investment is it?
No, mostly money market fund, but they don't really give financial advice. They're just kind of like the middle guy. They kind of handle all the funds that come into their office, and it goes to, I think it's J.P. Morgan actually is who's the one who's actually doing all the, you know, the investment decisions.
Okay.
I just thought it was kind of high.
And how are they billing you for that, Joe? Is it something that's showing up like on your quarterly statement where they're saying, hey, we deducted, you know, $300 or whatever out of your account this quarter?
Correct, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That is high. It's not outrageous if it is. If it works out to 2% per year, that's higher. If you're getting something that's worth it to you, it's fair. If you're not getting something that's worth it to you, no price is reasonable. So I would talk to them about it and say, is there a way that I can get this service without paying this cost? If there's not, you might want to look elsewhere. Like you mentioned, shop around. And I would consider some of the do-it-yourself places like Vanguard, Schwab. Schwab custodies the accounts for clients I work with on an ongoing basis. Fidelity is also very good. TD Ameritrade offers this service as well. USAA is another good one as well. But those companies generally offer some service for little or no cost. I mean, there is some cost to it, but it's not this high. And again, you know, the service generally isn't personalized. You don't get one dedicated person to work with usually, but you can at least get some help and some benefit from it without having to pay those fees. And again, it's not outrageous, but there are places you can go to get what it sounds like you're getting from this for a lower cost.
Thank you very much, Joe. Good luck to you. On Facebook, Dave writes, with his infinite knowledge and wisdom, can Kevin suggest a few family budget programs to get a better handle on how a family is doing?
Infinite.
Infinite, yes. Knowledge.
Infinite. I would say infinite ability to keep talking about money, whether it's wise or not. No, there's been so far no end to this. Yeah, I'd start out maybe at mint.com. That's a nice program. A lot of people like it. It can be free, but it's one of those ad-supported programs, so you have to keep an eye out for it. And there's a couple other ones that that allow people to track their expenses. I would also, a lot of people who are struggling with covering monthly expenses are also struggling with debt. And excuse me, one of our favorite sites for getting some help with dealing with debt is debtadvice.org. Debtadvice.org not only has a lot of different articles and calculators you can use to kind of keep an eye on spending and debt, but also it can help you find a debt counselor in your area who can maybe give you some free or low cost advice on trying to get a handle on your expenses and more specifically your debt. And we'll put a link up to those websites, and there are a couple other ones out there that I have on my files in the office, but mint.com and debtadvice.org. We'll put that up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
All right, thanks to Dave. Now to Dan in Middleton.
Hi there.
Dan.
Hi. I had a comment and then a question regarding the retired woman who's looking to buy a house. I was thinking, since I have one of these myself, would she be better off having a home equity line of credit, buying the house outright, and then having a line of credit against the house that she's not really paying interest on unless she taps into that money? And second, I guess I had more of a question about reverse mortgages. I'm not really interested myself, but I see lots of advertisements for them, and I just get the sense they're kind of like these payday loan, that they're like really nasty kind of terms to it that are going to yank people's homes away from them before they really want to give them up.
You don't think
it's a good point and a good question, a good catch, Dan. The home equity line of credit is another good option for people who do not wish to get a new mortgage, don't quite need a reverse mortgage yet, if ever, but also do want to get some kind of access to their equity in an emergency. The home equity line of credit is the path of least resistance to getting that equity. What you do is you contact your lender, say, I want to open a home equity line of credit. And depending on your condition, the equity in your home, they will give it to you. And then usually some fees to get this started and open it up might be a few hundred dollars to get it started. And it allows you to draw from the equity in your home without having to get a new approval. And you basically write checks for it. You only have to pay interest on what you borrow. And then typically you keep that going for several years. And then they turn it into a fixed loan if you can't pay it off at that particular time or you don't want to pay it off. The reverse mortgage is a very good tool. It's very effective. The problem is there are a bunch of hucksters getting in, and if you're unfortunately stuck on a sofa watching daytime television and especially cable shows, you'll see these ads all the time for these people. They're not as good as what the people make it seem. They're not as bad as the commercials make it seem either, because you think, like, gosh, Dan, you have a right, the attitude about this is saying, I would not want to buy anything from these people, much less turn over the rights to my home. The reverse mortgage gives you money up front against the equity in your home. You have to be over 62. You have to have equity in your home. And it's usually they give you about two-thirds of the available equity in your home. So let's say you have a paid-for $200,000 house. You may be able to get about $120,000 check from the reverse mortgage lender right now. It's tax-free. There's no loan application process. The fees to begin are pretty high, usually several thousand dollars. But once that's done, you don't have to pay that loan back until you move out of the house for at least 12 months or you pass away, in which case I would hope you would also move out of the house for at least 12 months. Then the lender sells the house. If the lender sells the house for more than the what you owe, you or your estate will get the difference. If the lender sells the house for less than what you owe, part of the fees and the taxpayer make up the difference to the lender. So even if you borrow $100,000, let's say it goes up to $200,000 with interest and fees by the time you get out of the house, and the house is only sold for $100,000, you do not owe that difference, nor does your estate, nor do your heirs. So it's a nice way for people who can afford physically to stay in their house to do so without having to sell it and then, move to an apartment, try to use the proceeds to generate interest to pay rent or to buy another house.
Thanks very much, Dan, and good luck to you. Vivian in Green Bay is with us. Hello, Vivian.
Hello. Regarding charitable deductions on our income taxes, in the state of Wisconsin, when I pay my utility bill, I'm assessed a fee to support low-income families and help them pay their utility bills. That's mandated, I believe. May I take that as a deduction, as a charitable contribution?
I would guess not, since it is mandated and since it's probably not going to a qualified charity, a 501c3 charity. I'm guessing that you may not be able to take that, any kind of fee like that, for as a tax deduction whatsoever.
All right. Thanks, Vivian, for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. More of your calls are welcome at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email at onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. It's time now for Smart Assets, and savers are searching for ways to earn more on their money, and many have looked at dividend-paying stocks to boost their income. So tell us about this, Kevin.
It's understandable, and it's going to be a common theme here until and if ever interest rates on safe investments go back up. People are thinking, they're looking at CDs paying 1% to 2% and very worried that they're not earning enough to keep pace with inflation or to raise their living standard up enough to the level they would like it to be. If you own a stock, if you own shares in a stock, you're technically an owner in the business. And after the people running the business, running the company, pay for all their expenses of it, there's some money left over. And that dividend payment from that stock represents payment to the owners of the company. It's typically not all the profits. A lot of people running those companies like to keep that money around for future uses, but it is a good way to profit from owning this. Right now, the Standard & Poor's 500 index currently yields about 2%. That's better than most CDs pay. You'd have to probably buy a 15-year United States Treasury bill to get, or bond, to get a 2% yield on it. So compared to other options, that kind of yield on the stock is very attractive to people. But you need to know the good and the bad before you jump into something like this.
All right. Well, I like to start with the good. What's good about it?
Obviously, the higher yield is the primary attraction for some people, and that dividend yield reflects a lot of future potential price appreciation. Over the last 25 years, that S&P 500 index we've mentioned has made a little under 10% a year. About 40% of that gain, the 4% in real dollars, is from dividends and increased dividends as well. If you buy a stock right now, the dividend could be raised in the future if business is good and profits go up. And if it is raised, generally people are willing to pay more for a stock that does boost the dividend, pay a higher dividend, so you could get some appreciation in the stock price as well. And as of right now, there are some tax advantage to qualified dividends. You pay 0% tax on dividends paid from common stocks if you're in the 10 to 15% tax bracket, which the majority of people are, and only 15% tax on it if you're above that as well. So the money that you get in your pocket after taxes from a dividend will be higher than what it would be from a CD or taxable bond paying the same yield.
All right, that sounds good. What's the downside?
It's generally the opposite of the positives. The price can and will go down, and companies that have paid dividends in the past and seem like safe companies have even gone out of business, where you would, if you haven't sold the stock before that happens, you could lose all of your money. And because of the way the stock market works, it hasn't been very volatile lately, but it could become very volatile very quickly. And if it does, any advantage you've made by buying a stock that pays a higher dividend could be lost in the matter of seconds if the price of the stock falls a commensurate amount. And even if the stock stays strong, the dividend may not. Sometimes companies can cut their dividends or eliminate it completely so that they can keep more money on hand and not only keep the company afloat, but also to use it for other, you know, acquisitions or what have you. The tax advantages, while I think they will probably stay in place, they are scheduled to disappear at the end of the year. And unless Congress keeps those exemptions in place, you might lose the tax advantages, which will not only hurt your personal situation, but could also hurt the attractiveness of dividend-paying stocks as well. And those tax advantages obviously aren't important to you if the money you're investing is in your IRA or your Roth IRA, because the earnings are already sheltered from taxation, as are the dividends. And when you pull a dividend out of your IRA, you pay taxes on it. If you pull it out of a Roth IRA, there's no taxes anyway. So if you're looking at money in an IRA or Roth IRA, the tax advantages probably don't mean much to you.
Okay, so do you have any other advice or guidance for those who might still be interested in adding dividend-paying investments to their portfolios?
It is our overarching On Your Money investment philosophy. Expect the worst and hope for the best. Potential risk equals potential reward. So if the higher the dividend is of an investment you're considering, the more likely it is that you are going to lose money on it in the form of either the dividend disappearing or the price dropping or both. If you're looking at a stock, let's say you're looking at an XYZ company, it's been around for a long time and pays a good dividend. Go back to 2008, 2009, look at the drop that occurred to that particular stock during that time and see if you could handle it. Chances are you'll probably see a 30 to 40% drop during that period. And if you put $10,000 into an investment like that and it again drops 30 to 40%, you're looking at a net value of $6,000 to $7,000. If you can handle that, fine. If not, you probably should shy away from these. But even after that, if you go through it, you say, I'd really like to add this, maybe making a portion of your assets, probably look at doing it outside of your retirement accounts, because if it does go down, you'd like to be able to use some of the tax advantages of the loss that you can get by selling it and the dividend. And you may want to look at using a mutual fund instead of an individual stock. The risk probably won't be as high, the returns probably won't be as well, but it's more diversified, and there are several mutual funds out there that do specialize in dividend-paying companies.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. I'm Joy Cardine, and this is On Your Money. If you have a question for Kevin about money matters, about your personal finances, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Don in Madison is with us next. Hello, Don.
Hi, I got a couple questions. The first one, TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. I just bought a couple, and I paid a 6% premium for each one. What does this mean, and how do I find its present value?
Yeah, did you buy the bonds outright?
No. Through the website of Treasury.
You bought them directly from the Treasury. Okay, if you are going to buy these, that's a good way to do it. It means that you probably paid 6% over the face value of the bond, meaning if the bond were worth $1,000, you paid $1,060. Does that kind of jibe with your experience?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. And it means that, yes, you will get some yield off of this, but when the bonds finally come due, assuming they are paid off according to schedule, you'll only get $1,000, the face value of the bond, not the $1,060 for it. So you paid a premium to get the income stream from this, and that's common in these days. As interest rates go down, the premiums on previously issued bonds rise, so you're more likely to have to pay for that. It's not uncommon. The money didn't go to anybody special other than the person who owned the bond. It was worth more because interest rates have fallen.
Thanks, Don. Good luck. Ruth in Madison is with us next. Hello, Ruth.
Oh, yes. Thank you for taking my call. I have money invested in a tax-sheltered annuity that comes from an insurance company, and because it's not FDIC-insured, I now want to transfer that or start transferring that in chunks into my regular financial institution, and I really would not rather pay the taxes on it right now. So I'm wondering if generally will that money be eligible for me to transfer it as an IRA?
Ruth, is the money designated as an IRA right now within the annuity, or is it a non-qualified account?
It isn't an IRA, no.
Okay, then the answer is, and you can make a contribution with it to an IRA if you have earned income or if you're married to someone who has earned income, but otherwise, no, you cannot move it into an IRA. But if you do want to make it a little safer, is it in a variable annuity or a fixed annuity?
Yes, I have some in variable, most in variable, and some in the fixed. And
okay.
Then could I transfer it to a Roth?
That's also a good question, but no, you can't move it to a Roth IRA. The only thing you can do to make it safer is actually take the money out, and you will pay taxes on it. But again, just the earnings portion. So if you note the earnings portion of the account, that's the only amount that will be taxable. And you can probably do this over time. Let's say this is something we run into fairly frequently. People who have built up money in these annuities, don't want it there anymore, you can transfer over to a bank, which I think is advisable. I don't think that's the worst idea in the world. But I would like to see you pull it out periodically just to keep your income, again, below the 15% level as you can. So just pull portions out and then either spend it or move it into a certificate of deposit or savings bonds. But no, to answer your original question, you cannot move non-qualified money from an annuity into an IRA or Roth IRA at a bank.
All right. Thank you very much, Ruth, for the call, and good luck to you. Coming up on this edition of On Your Money, Kevin has some tips on saving some money on our morning cup o' joe, cup of coffee, and we'll have more answers to your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The cost of a cup of coffee has gone up, and sorry to say, it's likely to stay that way. But Kevin has a few tips to spending less on your daily dose of caffeine or getting more from it, or both. Kevin, you're a big caffeine fan in the morning?
It is my drug of choice. Mm-hmm. It's as I get older, I find that my number of vices have dwindled dramatically, especially since my college days. So coffee's about all I've got left to hang on for. And Rick, I really live on the wild side, as you can tell.
Yep, same here.
A bigger part of our lives than ever before. It's the world's most popular drink, and this is not the caffeine addiction is not an original issue. Johann Sebastian Bach actually penned a ditty, a sarcastic tone regarding the addictive properties of coffee back in the 1700s, and it was considered a very serious problem at that time, and obviously we haven't learned our lesson yet. The U.S. Consumes about a third of the coffee globally, about 1.7 billion cups a day. Recent prices of the beans are actually down quite a bit from highs last year, but the other expenses of producing coffee are up. Fuel costs, obviously, at $4 a gallon, getting all that stuff delivered around can go up. And Fast Company says that Starbucks spends more money on health insurance for its employees than it does on coffee beans. So those kinds of costs can lead to higher prices for you at the supermarket or in the coffee barista's stand. And so you need to know how to save now. And then later on, I will talk to you about our very innovative On Your Money invention for enjoying your coffee.
Yeah. So where should we start when it comes to saving money on our morning cup of coffee?
Well, where is the best place to start? Indeed, whether you're getting it at home or at work or on the go, if you're getting it on the go and you do need to buy it, watch for savings, whether it's you're buying it at a big chain or at an independently owned shop. Subscribe to the place's Twitter feed, friend them on Facebook, get their newsletter. If they have the buy 12, get one free card, definitely get that. Coffee is more effective as a jolt if you get several small doses during a day, about 20 milligrams an hour, according to an author in a book on the caffeine, the positive effects of caffeine. But the average coffee has about 100 milligrams. So if you down one and then don't drink another one for 2 or 3 hours, you probably aren't getting the maximum amount of boost out of that you other might be. Plus the other expenses, the half-half, triple-triple, double latte, mocha, skim, skinny, whatever. and then, if it takes a while for you to hang around the coffee shop to get your coffee, you want to sit in the laptop, do these people a favor. And at least, if you're not going to drink several different cups of coffee, you're taking up space, you're using the service, give a couple bucks extra tip to the counter person, leave it for the place, because it, they're not making any money on you sitting there as well. Now, however, if you are a coffee drinker, you will notice that buying it at, having someone make it for you, generally costs 20 to 40 times the cost of making it yourself. Plus, if you do make it yourself, it can be more convenient, and you can customize it to exactly the way that you want to do it.
Yeah, right. One of the disadvantages of coming into work at about 4 o'clock in the morning is I don't have any coffee shops to stop at. So what if I need to make my own coffee at home?
One of our favorite sites here at On Your Money is lifehacker.com, and they have several different long tutorials on how to make the best coffee you possibly can given your circumstances. And we'll put a link up to these at onyourmoney.com. But there are three main components. You got to have fresh beans, the fresher the better, and recently roasted is even better. And if you buy some and you can't obviously use them all right away, freeze what you can and don't grind them until you're just ready to make the coffee. Once you grind them, you can use one of those adjustable burr or the conical grinders. They can cost between $50 and $100 for a good one. And then there is the maker. Most of us use the Mr. Coffee drip maker that's all stained and nobody ever seems to wash it. Nobody ever cleans it. But well, you definitely want to wash it every single time you use it. And if it's getting regular use, you want to run a solution through that maker of 50% vinegar, 50% water at least once a week. And that will really boost the taste and pull out a lot of the acidity that you're already getting from previous brews of it. Also, only make what you will drink right away. Do not, one of the big sins of coffee making is when they leave the pot on the burner and they try to keep it warm, but that ends up just cooking the coffee and leaves a horrible taste after about 10 or 15 minutes. So definitely make what you're going to drink and put the rest in a carafe or some kind of pot.
I think I told you this before, Kevin, but we affectionately call the coffee pot, the Mr. Coffee Maker in our producer's booth, the cesspot. Mm-hmm. So,
cleaning that up may significantly reduce the health insurance costs of the Wisconsin Public Radio staff. It's probably, and also I'm guessing the UW-Madison Science Department might want to take it in for, see what kind of cultures they can get out of. There could be a new strain of penicillin, I bet.
There could, and I think that the legal department's going to want to know about this too, since guests usually are given coffee from that. But anyway,
yes,
no.
There's a lawsuit waiting to happen.
So let's say we can't make our own coffee at work or on the road. Any suggestions?
All you really need is hot water, and the optimal temperature to get the best flavors out of your coffee is typically about 200 degrees or so, and you can reach that temperature by getting water to a boil and then waiting maybe 10 to 20 seconds or so. Usually you'll be right around that 200 degree level, and the pour-over method is really a great way to make a great cup of coffee. The AeroPress is sold at Amazon.com, costs about $25. This thing has, I think, 1,600 enthusiastic reviews for making really great coffee at a very low cost and only needing hot water to be able to make the coffee. Now, in a car, that's another story, but there is a solution to that. Fiat is announcing a new vehicle called the 500L, which has, among its other options buyers can use, an espresso machine built into the dashboard.
Oh, my gosh. I'm going to have to just take one of those for a test ride. What?
Yeah, I think that one of the big problems we do have in the United States is people aren't distracted enough by while they're driving.
We do need
boiling hot vehicles and coffee while people careen down the freeway at 75 miles an hour while they're texting and talking on the cell phone and doing their makeup in the rearview mirror, whatever. Yes, we definitely need more distractions in the driver's seat.
Yeah, that is amazing. What's this innovative invention that you mentioned a little while ago?
Well, I'm willing to spill this because I have a deep affection for the On Your Money listeners, all several dozen of them, as Peter alluded to earlier. And so I will give you this amazing technology that I've come up with. It's called the Strawfee Cup. And you take an ordinary thermal coffee mug, one that's got, you know, the lid, and then it's got a little sliding thing on top of the lid that can shut it off. And you take a straw from McDonald's, a nice big straw, and stick it in there. And it's changed my life, really. And I haven't been able to get a patent on it yet. I don't know why, because those patent Nazis at the trademark office won't give it to me. But it not only keeps it warmer without having to heat it, but you don't get all those spills all over the place. And for the vain among us, it doesn't leave your lips all brown and your teeth all brown because you're not slurping coffee. And because you're not slurping coffee with all the air and sipping it, you won't annoy your coworkers quite as much as you currently do.
I like that idea. I thought of that whole thing of just the dribble and the spill factor is eliminated. But why does it keep it warmer? Just because...
Well, because you've got the lid. You don't have to open up. The only spot that you have open is just enough room for the straw to get through, and then it's closed after that. And you don't have to slurp it. And you don't have to open it back up again, and you don't have to slug it down. It just take a gentle, more elegant sip, if you will. Maybe a future premium we'll develop the On Your Money Strawfee Cup specifically to donors at a specific level.
I like it. That sounds good. I'm going to try that. Sounds good, Kevin. We have time for a couple more calls before this edition of On Your Money comes to an end. Chris in Grays Lake, Illinois is with us. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. I have a question regarding 401ks, 403bs. I've collected a number of them over the last 5 years and changing jobs. Every new job I get, I open up the 401k plan, put money in there, accept the employer's contribution. And now I have, three or four of them that are just sitting there collecting money. You know, I'm not putting any more money into them because I've left those employers. What do I do with them? Do I consolidate them? Do I leave them alone?
Mm-hmm. I think, Chris, a bigger problem or question we have for you is, why do you have such a hard time staying in one place?
He's moving onward and upward.
Are you a rambling man? Is there... It's upward.
It's onward and upward in each place, yeah. Yep.
All right, good for you. Yeah, there are three different ways to do this. One way is to do nothing. That's the easiest way, but then you end up calling into radio shows trying to get pithy advice on what to do with this. And so the better thing is either to do something with it, and that something, Chris, is to either, if it's possible, roll it all into your own employer's, current employer's plan. And you can do that if the employer will let you, the plan sponsor will let you. Then at least you only have one account to manage, and there are some tax advantages later on to having money in the 401k. However, some of those companies we mentioned previously, like Fidelity, Vanguard, Schwab, TD Ameritrade, USA, or your local bank or credit union, you can consolidate them there, and if you find a good one, they'll do all the work for you. Not only do you have more control over the money at that point, but you have a much bigger option over what you choose to invest in, whether it's certificates of deposit, treasury bills, different stocks, mutual funds, what have you. If you have it in a self-directed IRA at one of these accounts, they'll handle a lot of the paperwork for you, and you'll get more control over what you choose to do with the money. So I would either move it into your current employer if you like that account, then you've only got one account to deal with, or go find one of those other providers to give you a self-directed IRA.
Thanks, Chris. Good luck. Luann in Pewaukee is with us next. Hello, Luann.
Hi, Joy. Mm. And Kevin, hi. My question regards some savings bonds I have that are, some E's and some I's that I really, they're smaller ones, and I really don't want them. I want to give them to my grandchild, but I want to do it without having a tax liability. What do I have to do?
Tax liability mean in the sense of the gift tax?
Well, no, the sense of if I had to cash them in order to give them to the children, what would I do?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good question. Have you been to the savings bond website yet, Luann?
I did go there, but I was getting a little confused.
The savings bonds are great. Yeah, savings bonds are great investments, but the website at treasurydirect.gov, I really feel like they're trying to do their best. They're trying to help people and educate out, but it's a very confusing process for it. If you transfer it to someone else in the ownership, I don't think you can gift it down and transfer the tax liability. I can't remember if I answered this question 10 years ago probably for someone, and I couldn't remember what the answer was to that point. But the treasurydirect.gov talks about giving accumulated savings bonds for it. But how old is your grandson?
13.
13, okay.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, if you do give them to him, it's his money, and he can do with it whatever he wants once he reaches normal age. And also he can spend it however he wants. You might be better off you might be surprised. There's probably not a huge tax liability to that anyway, unless you're in a very high income right now. And have you had them more than 30 years, do you think? Like back to
No, they're more like 15-year-old ones probably.
Okay. I don't think the tax liability is going to be that high. I would prefer you actually cash it in and then open up an EdVest account, a college savings account for him with you as the owner. Then you keep control of the money. Someone's going to pay taxes on that money sooner or later, and I don't think you can shift that on to him and absolve yourself of that taxes. I think he's going to have to pay it. But I'll double check on that, and we'll address that in a future show, Luann.
Luann, thanks so much for the call. What a nice grandma you are. Let's talk about the website of the week in this final minute, Kevin.
Well, bills.com is a website that has a little tool called Ways to Save. Bills.com, ways-to-save. You can enter in all of the different things that you spend money on and find out what cutting back on that money will do for you, whether it's coffee, going to the movies, driving too much, buying songs on the internet, going out to drink and eat. bills.com/ways-to-save. We'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Sounds great. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Kevin will be off next Tuesday, but back with us after that. Next Tuesday, we are planning on talking about selling and buying a home, a special home edition of On Your Money, next Tuesday at this time. Thanks to Rob Ferret, to Bill Martins, and to Amanda Magnus for producing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.